everyone. It is Wednesday, January 29th, another day in the impeachment hearing. Now it's the Q&A section. This is the Attitude with Artie Artisan and producer Ken Barnes. Let me tell you why I know it's a beautiful day out. How do I know? No. I live in the attic across the street from an elementary school. Oh, yeah. And I know that the weather is perfection because they're throwing – I mean, kids are always going outside no matter what the weather is, which is I'm really grateful for. But when it's warm and slightly like just balmy in a little bit of way, they just – the noise gets louder and you know it's just a beautiful day and the kids are having a grand time. So that's my weather report. The children are bubbly. And on that night – it's true. I listen to the sounds of their voices and I kind of know I don't need the heavy coat. I need the lighter coat and that's how I judge it. I don't even need a thermometer. Just the sound of children's voices. And on that note, I know where you want to go because I read about it too. Jared Kushner was assigned the great Middle Eastern, you know, confab, and he was going to come out. He was going to pull a rabbit out of his hat. He pulled crap out of his hat. You know, it was – actually, he pulled BB out of his hat is what he pulled.
Yeah, so, what a surprise.
What a yikes. It's so damn predictable. But the story of the tunnels, you got to tell them the story of the tunnels because this is – how could they even say that and not be embarrassed? That I mean, I even put that into an agreement. It's just disgusting.
Yeah, it really is.
Oh,
and I was looking at the map that they are proposing for what this Palestinian state would look like. And they've got an underground tunnel from Gaza.
I know.
All the way across under Israel to the West Bank. And it's like, seriously? You think people are going to like walk through this however many miles it is long tunnel? And meanwhile, the tunnels out of Gaza into Israel were something that the Israelis were livid about and were fighting because the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip were using the tunnels to come out in Israel and throw bombs or whatever they do.
And now they've incorporated
And now they've incorporated into their plan. It's like, what? Who? What?
Right, are you it's going to have stoplights. It's going to have like little – oh, my God.
And then
embarrassing.
Within the West Bank, he's got – little enclaves, obviously, that are cut out of the Palestinian state, which he doesn't call a state, by the way.
What
just because they're Palestinian
territory?
I'm not sure. Territory.
Yeah, right.
But they don't say Palestinians will have sovereignty over it. The land that they propose for the Palestinians has these little pieces carved out of it for where settlements are, not just a couple of big settlements, which in 2000, Clinton and both Israel and Palestinian negotiators agreed there would be exchanges of the big settlement lands that are on the east of the Green Line inside Palestine and some lands in the Israeli side that would go to the Palestinians.
Yeah.
It's sort of a fair
exchange.
Trade, a fair exchange of land.
Yeah.
But here, there's no exchange. And all they do is they cut out land. And it's not just the big lands. There's these little teeny slices that cut in at the ends of the border.
It's evil.
And
it's
even,
evil.
Even within
I know.
The West Bank, there are all these areas which advocates like me have been complaining make the Palestinian territory non-contiguous.
Yeah.
On Trump's plan, there are these little arrows that are tunnels between this one piece of Palestinian land and the other piece of Palestinian land under the Israeli settlement. A little arrow here and a little arrow there, and there are like dozens of them.
I can't believe it.
They are insane.
They are insane.
Really, the most troubling part of this really is not the plan itself, but the fact that it's unilateral.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it was just Trump and Bibi, and the Palestinians were not only not negotiated with, they were not even consulted. They were not told what they were planning. And
It's so predictable. It's so predictable for this administration. He's doing it politically. This has no meaning. This is to serve Bibi politically. It's to serve Trump politically. He gets to hand this to his fanatical, you know, Jews and to the fanatical evangelicals.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only two group of people that will see any virtue in this. The rest of the world, like 98.999%, are going, are you kidding me? Oh, my God. Throw that away.
Right.
Oh, my God.
Right. And it, of course,
Sheldon Adelson is like on cloud nine.
Gives a boost to Netanyahu in his reelection campaign. You know, here he is. Oh, I've got a proposal that's backed 100% by the President of the United States.
It's
not going anywhere
it's
not agreed by anyone. So
we'll talk. Well, I think Mel Goodman's coming on tomorrow, so we're going to go everywhere tomorrow. But we might touch on that as well.
This other topic I want to mention briefly. Today is the 1-year anniversary of MPP, the inaptly named Migrant Protection Program, which Homeland Security uses to send people back to Mexico when they come across the border, asylum. And there's an article in NBCNews.com. It's a good article. It almost, when I read it, I was shocked because it opens with this narrative about a woman taking her children and being kidnapped in Mexico.
Right.
And it sounded just like the woman I talked to in Matamoros, Mexico, the other side of Brownsville, that I described on the air. But this is from San Diego and Tijuana. It's a different story, but it's the same story.
Exactly.
It's just unbelievable.
Different cast of characters, same story.
Yeah. And I also look back at the DHS Homeland Security plan for when it introduced MPP a year ago, and it says that this is humanitarian because they're sending these migrants to Mexico and the Mexican government will provide them with security and safety,
but the
Mexican government isn't doing squat for them.
Right, exactly.
And so they just sent them into the hands of predators.
Well, they assume that you won't ask
starvation.
The next question. They're saying this is more humanitarian because, and then you go to where the because is and you find out that none of that because, I mean, they have no fiduciary responsibility. Of these people. They don't care. They don't care.
Right.
They'll create their fairy tale. Mexico will take care of them. And they don't ask the question, are you?
Right.
No.
And so there are a couple of statistics in here. Out of the 60,000 people who have fled violence in their home countries and have been pushed across back into Mexico by the U.S., out of 60,000, only a couple of thousand of them have even had any kind of hearing and resolution of their cases. And something like 0.1% of them have been approved for asylum. So it's ridiculously bad even if you get through. And meanwhile, you wait for months and months and months.
And they're hoping that you just
with
go
the predators.
Home.
They hope you either die or go
home. Exactly.
Yeah.
That's what the whole intent is.
It's horrible.
It is horrible. Okay. Before we grab our first guest, an incredibly powerful and depressing story. I'm just going to warn you right now. But what am I going to do? And then I'm going to add to the depressing. So I have an aside always. And here is the aside. Oh, God, it's from Open Democracy. Anti-abortion laws, a war against poor women. Here's the subtitle. Given the amount of research that shows how ineffective punitive laws are in curbing the number of abortions women carry out, it is difficult to imagine any other reason that they exist other than to keep women out of the workforce and in poverty. Let me just read just two or three sentences of this article. Really phenomenal. The political fight against anti-abortion legislation is, in fact, a class battle. And the reality is that abortion is only illegal for poor women. Women with resources can always interrupt their unwanted pregnancies. Either they know a doctor who performs medical abortions for an exorbitant price, they have the resources to travel to a place where the abortion is legal, or they have the means to buy an abortion pill in their own country or elsewhere. Restricting access to safe abortions keeps women in poverty, perpetuates the cycle that prevents them from social mobility, and allows wealth to remain in the hands of the rich, particularly white men. Deciding if and when to have a child is essential for a woman's economic and psychological well-being. It has implications for her education and for entering the workforce. In 2018, a study based on interviews with 813 women in the United States throughout 5 years, researchers found that women who had abortions denied to them were more likely to be in poverty within 6 months compared to women who were able to interrupt the pregnancy. Women who were denied abortions were also less likely to have full-time work and more likely to depend on some form of public assistance. Both effects remained significant for 4 years, everyone. And then the last sentence, the study concludes that women who were denied an abortion were more likely than women who received an abortion to experience economic difficulties and insecurity for years. Laws restricting access to abortion may lead to worse economic outcomes for women. And it is, you got to read it. You got to read it. Keep them barefoot. Keep them pregnant. Keep them from basically, you know, entering the workforce. Keep them dependent on abusive men. It's so true. It is so true. All right, everyone. That was my aside for today. Now I go to dive deep into the first article in our first interview. I don't know, Mark Edelman, but everything that you wrote, I don't know if you saw what I sent you this morning, but I sent you my Facebook post from the other day after listening to Morning Joe, and I finished listening to the TV show, and I had my middle fingers up in stereo and raced to my computer. And then, of course, when I was reading your article, I kept thinking, oh, my God, God, you're like my kissing cousin. And the title of Mark Edelman's piece is How Capitalism Underdeveloped Rural America. Mark Edelman teaches anthropology at Hunter College and the City University of New York Graduate Center. Let me just read the sort of subtitle, which is much better than the title itself. A Toxic Brew of Economic Suffering, Racism, and Community Decline prepared the groundwork for authoritarian populism in America's devastated rural areas. Trumpism will not be defeated unless the left can promote a progressive agenda to rebuild rural America. Amen. Welcome to the program, Mark.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Well, I'm delighted. I think I'm delighted to have you. So, in a way, what was so interesting about your piece, and you saw the piece that I posted on Facebook, was that you kind of expanded on every single bullet that I had written. But then you really sort of directed it to what really is happening in rural America. And just as a quick aside, Mark, I'm originally a kid from Bay Ridge, Brooklyn. I was raised on Long Island. I went to school in sort of, you know, these relatively urban areas. But I ended up moving to northern New Hampshire. I moved to a town of 1,000 people. I became the president of the largest poverty agency in the northern part of my state, which also happened to be the second largest employer in that northern part of the state, and it was a poverty agency. So and I remember all the rural hospitals closing. I remember the paper mills closing, and they were begging for a prison just to have a job. So as I'm reading your piece, I am thinking about the northern part of my state, but, you know, in a lot of ways, it is just replicated everywhere in rural America, and the consequences are devastating, and Trump is part of it. So walk us through what you did, which was sort of go through the list after list after list of what is happening. And by the time I got done with the article, no wonder they're pissed off, and no wonder it's so easy for them to be manipulated and that their anger be focused on the wrong thing, because right now, no one seems to care.
Well, what I can tell you is this article was written with the encouragement of a group of friends and colleagues, many of them from abroad, because I'm a city kid, too, but I've spent quite a bit of time in the countryside, but mostly in developing countries. And my colleagues from South Africa and the Philippines and Europe were saying to me, well, you should do research on your own country for once. Huh. And I took up the challenge, and I started to look at the poverty indicators.
Right.
And the poverty indicators in the United States are actually quite shocking, particularly if you don't just look at the 12 or 14% or so of the population that's below the official poverty line, which is around $25,000 for a family of four. But if you look at the population that's within about, say, 150 or 200% of the poverty line, it's not an exaggeration to say that the U.S. has a poor or near-poor majority, 50-something percent.
Yeah.
So I was thinking, why aren't politicians, even the most progressive ones, acknowledging this in these terms? Why isn't there more outrage? Or maybe the better question is, what forms does the outrage take among those who are most affected? Then I start to ask, where did all that wealth go? Hmm. And it's really a connecting the dots article. I think almost anybody could have written it, because I think there are a lot of different ways in which wealth is being extracted from rural regions, and not just rural regions, inner city regions as well. The basic upshot is it's being shifted upward in class terms and outward in geographical terms. And I started to reflect on what a Canadian farmer said to me many years ago in Saskatchewan. He said, what do you notice is the difference between the communities that are thriving and the ones that are dying? And I said, I don't know. And he said to me, well, the ones that are thriving still have a credit union and a cooperative grain elevator.
Wow.
And this jibed completely with what I'd seen in Central America, where the communities that were thriving had some means of appropriating more of the value added that they produced. Maybe it was a local agro-industry, maybe it was a credit union of some kind. But as soon as those institutions begin to disappear, it gets much harder to for people to have a prosperous and meaningful life because their community institutions are undermined. Then I start to look at the psychological research literature on how stress predisposes people to accept authoritarian demagogues and to believe simplistic, even if very far-fetched, conspiracy theories. So what happened? Well, first, particularly since the 1980s and in worsening forms of the crisis in 2008, the population is impoverished. Then you get the population indebted to paper over the worst effects of being poor. Then you get them working multiple low-wage jobs in the gig economy so that they're constantly off balance and exhausted. Stress levels are going up because of debt, because of the work situation. You can sell them drugs for the physical and emotional pain and the stress they experience. And all this is happening as communities are unraveling. They no longer have the tax bases to support their schools or other institutions adequately. And in this terrible context of a decomposing society, you present a demagogic authoritarian figure who blames her distress not on financial actors or big corporations, but on immigrants, people of color.
Exactly.
And
the
so
other.
On.
The other. So I've told this story a million times. I want to tell it really quickly to you now. I'm running for Congress in 1996. It's right after the Welfare Reform Act. I oppose the Welfare Reform Act for a whole host of reasons. I'm invited to one of the most poor communities in my state called Lisbon, New Hampshire. And I show up in this little poor community, and there's a bunch of large men who used to work in the timber and paper industry. And they meet me at the door. And as I walk in, they say, "We hate you." And I looked at them and I said, "Have we met?" And the reason they hate me is that they think that I support those welfare women. And those welfare women get what they don't have. Those welfare women get Medicaid so they can go to a doctor when they're sick. Those welfare women get access to daycare because they are Head Start and they don't have any way to sort of provide for their children when they're at work. And then they get these welfare women get food stamps and Section 8 and they're struggling, you know, paying their mortgage and a property tax that's eating 30% of their income. And they went through this laundry list of all the reasons why they hated welfare and they hated those welfare women. And you don't want to change the welfare system? So I looked at them and I said, "Boy, I'd be pissed too." And I said, "But I have a question for you. How does taking all that away from welfare women get it for you? It sounds like the problem isn't welfare. It sounds like the problem is work. When you can work 60 hours a week and not provide for your family, there's something wrong with work. When you can work 60 hours a week and you don't have health care, there's something wrong with work." But exactly what you just wrote about, Professor Edelman, is exactly what I was saying to them. They were being told where to focus their anger, not on the boss, not on the companies that were being stripped and flipped, not on the banks that basically had eaten up all their small banks and pulled them out, not on the hospitals that were disappearing. They were blaming it on welfare women because it was the easy target and it was what they were told.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with your perception of it. It's, in a way, really quite tragic.
Yes.
If one looks at the net flow of tax revenues in many rural zones, they often receive much greater benefit from various kinds of federal subsidies. And in net terms, the urban areas are paying for that, but many people still have the idea that self-reliance is what's happening when really the population is directly or indirectly fairly dependent on certain kinds of subsidies. And that's not necessarily a bad thing either because we live in a society. We're not just a conglomeration of individuals in our own little bunkers.
Yeah, but you also talk about the loss of the local community bank, the loss of the credit union, the loss of the small hospital, the loss of the public libraries. You go through all these pieces and everything that would really sort of reinforce the potential for being able to thrive, the potential for being able to pull yourself up by your own bootstraps. You can't pull yourself up if you don't have a hospital to go to when you get sick. You can't pull yourself up if you don't have a school to educate your kid in order to make sure that that kid could actually have a viable job that produces real income. All those pieces that make it possible for success have been taken away. No wonder they're furious.
Well, no, I wasn't only looking at the poverty indicators. I was looking at health indicators, too. And that's often a very good window for looking into a society and seeing how things are going. And in the states that have the highest maternal mortality in the United States, Louisiana, I believe, is the worst highest for that. The maternal mortality rate is worse than in El Salvador and Iraq. That's the level to which we've descended here, and it's directly related to hospital closures and the erosion of tax bases and the inability of particularly rural hospitals to attract patients who have private insurance.
Yep, exactly. It's a vicious cycle.
The crazy private healthcare system we have is reinforcing this vicious circle for sure.
What you mentioned about Louisiana, I just want people to know the statistic that you – I'm looking feverishly through your article to find it. But so Louisiana is the worst. So Louisiana, I think it was you said in 2016, the mortality rate in birth was 50%. 50% died.
No, it wasn't 50%.
Oh.
It was 56, I think, per thousand.
Oh, okay, 56 per thousand. Okay,
very high.
It's still very high. I mean, I'm reading this number and I'm going, oh my God! And then you said it was the same as El Salvador, basically about the same as El Salvador. And then you talk about the fact that what's happening to these rural hospitals is that they're not able to survive. There, a lot of the rural hospitals. You know what's happening? If they do exist, what are they getting rid of? One of the most expensive parts of a rural hospital is the OBGYN. So they're getting rid of their birthing centers at their rural hospitals. But if you get rid of the birthing centers, where do these rural people go? Because now they have to travel, instead of 20 minutes, they have to travel 2 hours. And who with health insurance is going to go to a hospital that doesn't have the necessary services that you need if you get sick? So you're not going to go to the hospital. I mean, it's this sort of vicious cycle of failure.
Just yesterday on this show, I talked a little bit about a woman who's a doctor in Mississippi. Neonatal specialist, and she was talking about how Mississippi, the whole state, has only 20 neonatal specialists in the whole state.
The
woman that interviewed her said that she's in Boston, and within walking distance of where she's sitting, there are, you know, a dozen hospitals, each of which has more than 20 neonatal specialists. So if you don't have the care, obviously you don't have the hospitals, and you don't have any of the substrata of people who are providing social service, making sure the doctors and nurses are taking care of your patients.
Let me give people the accurate number. You're absolutely. I'm sorry. I misread it, but it's still outrageous. Between 1990 and 2015, the number of maternal deaths per thousand in the United States soared to 26.4. In Louisiana, it reached a shocking 58.1, the same rate as Jordan, slightly worse than what is found in El Salvador and Iraq. During the same period, this is the most important part of your whole piece in some ways. During the same period, Mark, maternal deaths dropped 10 per thousand in Germany. They dropped 10 per thousand in France, Japan, Canada, and the UK. What do we know about those countries, and what do we know about us? I mean, this is a statistic that should be laid on the table during the 2020 debate. You know, we keep talking about health care, and we should.
What we know about those countries is that unlike the United States, they have a robust system of social provisioning that includes universal health care.
Right.
Very different models in Germany and in the UK and Canada and so on, but people there do not have the anxiety over their health that people in the United States routinely experience, because there aren't private insurance companies that make their money by denying care.
So, Mark, you said you were encouraged by folks where you were working in South Africa and around the world to sort of study your own country. So I guess one of the questions is, and there must be someone who studied this, but we talk about anxiety, and anxiety has repercussions far beyond what happens from people's health. I mean, it has repercussions for families. I am kind of curious. Is there less addiction in those countries that have universal health care than what we are seeing in this country that's still wedded to a big pharma and a big insurance? Because I have this feeling that because of all these failures in our health care system, there's a greater raison d'etre to basically, you know, use drugs as the solution for everything. And then we see this addiction spike. Do we see the same level of addiction in those countries that have universal health care?
I wouldn't be able to speak to that with any real authority, but what I would say, and what I note in the article, that the levels of opioid use in the United States are quite staggering.
Yes.
Roughly a bit more than a third of the adult population in the United States takes opioids in any given year. So we're talking about almost 100 million people.
Oh,
and not all of them, not most of them even, are abusing them necessarily, but it makes the drugs available for people who are in pain, either physical pain or emotional pain.
Right.
And it certainly is a contributing factor to the opioid epidemic and the meth epidemic as well.
And again, what I've always said this, and I'm going to need to let you go. What is so remarkable to me is the two states that are really sort of have acute problems with overdosing and the opioid problem are West Virginia and New Hampshire. And here's what's so shocking to me, Mark. New Hampshire is one of the wealthiest states in the nation. West Virginia is one of the poorest states in the nation. How come we're bookends on that statistic? That, to me, should say something about people's sense of hope, desperation, and looking for something in the way of a response. And it may not just be about economics, but obviously we're not providing people with the kind of therapy they need and the kind of hope that they clearly feel like they're missing. Mark Edelman teaches anthropology at Hunter College and the City University of New York Graduate Center. His piece, a really frightening and depressing piece, but it puts it all together in one article, which I guess is why it makes it both powerful and helpful. The title of the piece is, let me just grab it again. Hold on, everyone. It is How Capitalism Underdeveloped Rural America. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Arnie. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. All right, everyone. A little labor history is next. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1834. That was the first time in United States history that a president called in federal troops to settle a labor dispute, and it certainly would not be the last. President Andrew Jackson ordered federal troops to quiet the workers on the Chesapeake and Ohio Canal. The workers were predominantly Irish, but also included Germans, Dutch, and African Americans. They were digging a canal along the route of the Potomac River, which had rapids that made it difficult to traverse. The primary purpose of the canal was to bring coal from the Allegheny Mountains to eastern port cities. The goal was to connect the ports to the Ohio River and Ohio Valley. Work on the project was grueling. Rocky ground made digging the canal extremely difficult. Workers labored 12 and even 15 hours a day. They often had to work in ditches with mud or water up to their waists. They lived in poor conditions in shanty towns along the canal route. In 1932, cholera swept through the work camps, leaving death in its wake. Work stoppages plagued the project, which had originally been conceived by George Washington. 10 different significant incidents of labor unrest occurred during the more than two decades the project was underway. Workers became fed up with hard labor, low wages, and dangerous conditions. Andrew Jackson sent in troops to stop the workers' rebellion. The C&O Canal never made it to the Ohio Valley. The coming of the railroad derailed the completion of the project 180 miles from its planned ending point. All was not lost, however, as the president's action to send in troops to suppress workers set a precedent that others would follow in the years ahead. Labor History in Two brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. American drivers spend a lot of time going nowhere, from warming up the engine to sitting in traffic or stuck at a drive-thru. all those idling cars,
surprisingly, consume about 3 billion gallons of fuel annually, and that produces about 30 million tons of CO2.
Patricia Weikersheimer of the Argonne National Laboratory says that pollution can be reduced. Many drivers keep their engines running because they believe that restarting burns more fuel than idling. But research shows it's usually more efficient to shut off the car.
Idling more than 10 seconds in your passenger vehicle consumes more fuel and produces more CO2 than does turning it off and starting it back up again.
So she suggests that drivers turn off their engines when they're stopped at train crossings or drive-thrus. School pickup and drop-off zones are especially important places to shut off the engine, because that also reduces kids' exposure to tailpipe pollution. Weikersheimer says reducing idling is a zero-cost way to save fuel, cut carbon pollution, and improve air quality. And it starts with drivers asking themselves,
do I need to have my engine on now?
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Done a thing for me. I ain't pretty like my sister, small like my dad, but good like my mama. A hot September night. Now that may not be love, but it is all right.
Talking about Davos, it's money I love. Where else do they have more money in one little tiny location on the planet but Davos? This is the editor with Arnie Artisan and producer Ken Barnes. We all know who sings that.
Yeah, well, it's Randy Newman.
Oh,
and
God.
He is wonderful.
Oh, God. I mean, I'm just sitting there going, please, why didn't I take piano lessons? That's all I keep thinking. All right. So let me sort of set this up. Joining us right now is our guest who didn't get to hear. I'm so sorry I didn't connect him. We were playing It's Money I Love by Randy Newman, and I told my audience we had to be talking about Davos if that's what we were doing. I go to theconversation.com all the time. You know what? I love it. I've encouraged professor friends of mine to write for it. They're writing for it. It has been just an incredible wealth of knowledge, connected me with PhDs and professors both in the United States and around the world, and I so value it. Christopher Michelson teaches at the University of St. Thomas. The title of his piece was How CEOs, Experts, and Philosophers See the World's Biggest Risks Differently. And Professor Michelson is an ethics professor and business advisor. It almost seems mutually exclusive. Anyway, an ethics professor and business advisor who studies how meaning and purpose in life and at work can improve our own and others' lives. His work has appeared in a wide variety of academic and trade publications, from the staid and serious MIT Sloan Management Review to the humor site McSweeney's Internet Tendency. He is currently working on a book of stories about meaningful work. Well, I actually have meaningful work, Christopher. My problem is I wish it would pay. But anyway, and sometimes compensation isn't everything, but in some ways paying the bills is. So welcome to the program.
Thank you very much for having me. And I have to say that one of the tensions that I often talk with my students about is whether meaning and money have to be separate from each other. And I think oftentimes they are, but they don't necessarily always exist in tension.
No, and for those who can actually accomplish both, let me just say something. When you do, you know you're beyond rich, and then you want to share it with others. I think that meaningfulness and success, financial success, gives you a sense that you need to sort of include more people in opportunity. You know, and
well,
that's my personal feeling, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah, I don't think you're wrong, but I did start studying meaningful work in part inspired by an email that I got from a student when I was teaching at the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School, where most of my students, they were going to school in Philadelphia. They wanted to get to Wall Street in New York. I actually was commuting from New York City at the time, and a student of mine who had graduated told me that his mother was upset with him that he had decided to work for a hedge fund instead of becoming a school teacher. And he asked me whether the choice of a job was an ethical choice. And instead of answering his question, I just asked him questions back and encouraged him to answer his own question. But I started thinking about meaningful work when he said that his plan was to get really rich at a hedge fund in New York until he was age 40. And then he would retire and golf and give his money away. And I asked him whether he really thought that by age 40, at that time, he would think that he had enough money, especially if he had a family to support by then and it was their money that he was giving away. And I also brought up the prospect that, speaking of depressing conversations, whether he might not make it to age 40. You know, so this was not long after 9/11. And, you know, I lived and worked in New York on 9/11, and a lot of people died that day who
were hedge fund
maybe
managers.
Had ambitions similar to his.
So, oh, God, this conversation just is blowing my mind. And you've heard me say this before, Ken. So when Hillary Clinton decided to run for president, she left the Secretary of State's office, and there was 15 months before she actually formally announced that she was running. And in that 15-month period, Christopher, she basically accumulated $21 million in that short period of time. And it was not for her campaign. It was for her personal portfolio. But the time that she was raising all that additional money before she did the jump to run for president, she and Bill were one of the richest ex-presidents ever. And there was a question. I know Hillary Clinton. She would never come on the air with me, no surprise. But here was the question I wanted to ask Hillary Clinton. In a way, it's what you were saying to this young man that you knew. And that is, so, Mrs. Clinton, when are you rich enough?
Mm-hmm.
When are you rich enough? Ken.
Could I just add also, shortly before I graduated from law school, I was one of the few people who was interested in working in a public interest job and foregoing making $1 million on Wall Street, which is what my dad kept hoping I would do and urging me to do. But most of my classmates had exactly the same point of view that your student did. You know, I'd work, I'd make the big bucks, I'd pay off my student loans, I'd accumulate a bunch, and then I'd retire early and give my money away or work for some public interest thing. And you know what? It's so addictive, the easy money that comes in. Not that it's easy, they work very hard, but having that, you get used to the lifestyle of big bucks and having the money available for any trip you want to make or whatever you want to do. And none of them retired early.
None, I know.
Except, you know, retired like at 60 to go play golf. But none of them did that, I'm not going to be a capitalist anymore.
Well, since we have to get into your article, but I really wish that you would do some research and ask all these successful, you know, men and women, when are you rich enough?
Mm-hmm.
And that to me is the most poignant question, because that's what you were saying to that young man. Would you really retire at 40? Would there be enough at 40? But when is enough?
It is a really poignant question, and I will look into it.
Please.
I am fortunate enough to know a lot of people who are richer than I am.
Yeah.
So
I figured you did.
I have a lot of people I could ask.
Good.
I don't think making money is a bad thing
in
itself, but the idea that the market actually rewards us commensurate with what we contribute, I think, is kind of a folly. The market is not a perfect measure of the meaningfulness of what we contribute.
Absolutely. So let's get into your article at the conversation.com that I told you was one of the most depressing articles I had read. And really what you point out is you wrote, the World Economic Forum's annual meeting in Davos put environmental risks at the top of its agenda, while the world's CEOs see overregulation as their biggest threat. So using your article as our GPS, sort of walk us through this sort of interesting way of looking at the world and determining what are risks, because I'm just so surprised that even at this late date, they're still looking at overregulation as their problem and not survival.
Well, you know, I understand how you could think that this is a depressing article, and in one sense, how could a report on the biggest risks facing our existence not be kind of depressing? But let's remember, first of all, the point of doing studies like these isn't necessarily to foretell doom, but actually to anticipate it, avoid it, inform it, incite mitigation steps.
Excellent.
So I suspect the part that depresses you the most has to do with the CEO's seeming lack of focus on what I consider to be the gravest risks. Instead, they're more short-term focused on their own economic growth.
So,
I think one thing that I should caveat this conversation with is that these are two different studies, and they're actually two different studies that I've had a hand in at one point or another. I was actually on the editorial board of the CEO study for 10 years, and I've been a participant in the risk study from time to time. And they survey different audiences. One surveys CEOs, and one surveys a variety of risk experts, included but not limited to CEOs, so also including issue experts, policymakers, academics like me, and so on. And they ask different questions. The CEO survey asks about risks to your company's growth, whereas the risk study asks about risks to the world in the next year. So that's part of the explanation for why they have different answers.
Okay. Well, you know, many years ago, I was reading a Wall Street Journal article, and I remember, like, going on a – I go on tirades a lot. I went on a tirade because they asked CEOs, what do they value more, honesty or loyalty? Guess what came up first? Loyalty. And as I was reading your article, I kept going back to – and that article was written in the 80s. It was a long time ago. And I was thinking about that as I was reading this, and I'm thinking about – can we teach them differently? Can we teach them that they have to think beyond the short term? Can we teach them about their fiduciary responsibility, not just to their stockholders and not just to their employees, but to the world? Is there a way for us to reformulate what it is they're looking at? Because I think the lens that they look at is so small that they can talk about overregulation, but the lens that we really have to look at is this small planet that we live on.
Yeah, so there's another tract, even older than the one that you mentioned, that you reminded me of, which is Machiavelli's The Prince, which basically asks the question, would you rather be feared or loved? And the typical CEO answer is, I'd rather be feared. But I think we live in an age when we need CEOs to want to be loved. So let me say about the article directly. The article focused on CEOs' tendency to put economics before ethics. And that's economics before ethics, not necessarily instead of ethics. So that's a little bit of good news, but it's bad news when they focus on their narrow economic interests instead of their common environmental and social interests.
Right.
So just as an example, at the World Economic Forum annual meeting, after Greta Thunberg addressed the forum and called for banks to stop investing in companies that were heavy polluters, some bank executives counterattacked by saying it wasn't their job to be the ethics police. It's really only not their job when they frame their responsibility as one in which they maximize shareholder value in the foreseeable future. It would be their job if they framed their job as serving stakeholders, which is anybody affected by their business, not just shareholders. There's a little bit of good news, though, I think. Maybe more than a little bit of good news. First of all, the theme of that meeting was stakeholders for a cohesive and sustainable world. And Klaus Schwab, who is the founder and president of the World Economic Forum, claims to be one of the forefathers of what's called stakeholder capitalism. And stakeholder capitalism says that the purpose of business is to serve stakeholders' interests, employees, managers, shareholders, the community and suppliers and others, including potentially the environment. You may remember that in August, the business leaders of the Business Roundtable, which is a consortium of large American business leaders, they put out a statement that said, the Business Roundtable has redefined the purpose of the corporation to serve stakeholders. Now, they didn't invent that, but I think they want to mean it. But I actually don't think they know quite how to do it yet, which is why the point of my article is that they still put economics before ethics. It's more measurable, and they're obsessed by measurement.
So let me tell you why putting economics before the environment or before the stakeholder is problematic. Because I would love to be at Davos and say, here's the problem when you put economics first. The problem is what you do with your lobbyists. The problem is what you do with your money. The problem is the revolving door. The problem is the regulations that you like and the regulations that you don't. And you know how exactly how to put the pressure points on to make sure that the regulations – so what happens with – it's not like I have to work within the level playing field and I'm going to be successful. It's that the money then gives you access to manipulate the playing field so that you are successful and the rest of us are not. And that is where I find the overregulation and the economics so problematic, because it isn't that they want a fair system. They want their system. And that is a real challenge, I think, for CEOs, because that's why I don't care if they're going to talk about the ethics or the environment of the stakeholders second. They may never get to second because they've created a landscape that basically insulates them from ever getting to number two.
I think that is the case some of the time. And one reason that I'm optimistic, actually, is that the next generation of leaders is not necessarily a generation that was conditioned by the mantra of maximize shareholder value in the way that the current generation of leaders was. I do think that there's a transition in progress. And I've been teaching for about 17 years now, and I find it easier to engage my students in a discussion about ethics and the environment than I did 17 years ago when I began. It's almost like they want to talk about it now, whereas I used to have to persuade them it was important to talk about.
So how do we support this transition from stockholder value to stakeholder value? I wrote a piece a couple weeks ago where I was talking about the fact, you know, they accuse Bernie of being a democratic socialist. And yet if you look at the countries that he points to that he wants to replicate, Finland, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, you know, all those Scandinavian countries like you and me know from living in places like Minnesota. And that is, when you look at those countries, they will tell you that they're capitalists. But they describe themselves this way. My friends in Norway, because I went to school at St. Olaf, will tell me they're compassionate capitalists. They're stakeholder capitalists, but they are capitalists. So in a bizarre way, even as people don't understand what Bernie's talking about, when you look at the countries in which he is pointing to, the concept of stakeholder is resonant, not the concept of shareholder. That doesn't mean that they're not wildly successful and they live in places that are very, very comfortable for a lot of people. But in a bizarre way, we don't even understand that there is a choice, and the choice doesn't mean that you won't be monetarily successful, but it also means that you will care about more than just that temporary monetary success.
I think that's right. I'm going to throw one other interesting country into the mix, and that's China. I actually am half Scandinavian, half Chinese, and China is another country where we might describe it as socialist, but its economy is largely capitalist today, and I think that's a really important country, obviously, because of its size and influence and so on, to understand how that evolution occurs. I think one positive development coming from Davos is that there was a recommitment to something called triple bottom line reporting.
Okay, so what does that mean?
Yeah, so typically we think of business as having a single bottom line, a financial bottom line. Triple bottom line reporting is in which companies don't only report their financial results, but they also report their social and environmental performance. Hmm. So scores of companies who were represented at Davos signed up to the new World Economic Forum International Business Council accounting standards for reporting on social and environmental impact. What that means is that people who are investing based upon a triple bottom line, members of the public like us who are concerned about company activities, will have a more level playing field on which to evaluate company performance based on these three bottom lines when they are using the same kinds of measures.
So are my hedge fund managers and my investment counselors and my Goldman Sachs assisting me in knowing that, are encouraging me to evaluate that? Because in a way, you know, these guys don't operate in a bubble. They operate because, you know, those of us that are being given guidance as we make our investments, those companies that are roaringly successful, you have to change more than one piece, you know, and I'm just trying to figure out how do we sort of spread the knowledge wealth?
Yeah, I think we have to make decisions as consumers, as investors, as citizens, as students, as managers, executives. You know, we all play probably multiple roles in the economy.
Exactly.
And sometimes we have ideals as citizens that we don't necessarily live out as consumers. You know, if a sustainably sourced product is more expensive than a comparable product, are we making decisions for ethics or for economics ourselves? It's easy for us to point fingers at business executives, but what are we doing as private citizens?
Exactly. So, yes, Ken.
So a couple of questions here. One is, how do you define stakeholder? I think that the move from stockholder considerations only to stakeholder considerations can be more or less beneficial to the world, depending on how you define which stakeholders you're going to consider and how you're going to allocate your decision-making to benefit the stockholders versus the other stakeholders. So if you consider the stakeholders to be only
you can gerrymander your stakeholders.
Exactly. If you don't include the poor people who live in Harlem as a stakeholder, then
it's problematic.
It's problematic. And also, similarly, even if you do include all the stakeholders in the world, how do you allocate your profit sharing among all of them? Do you need to give your stockholders 90% of the profits and you'll divvy up the other crumbs to various environmental or other important public interest groups?
Answer the first question, though. How do you define stakeholder?
That's a good question. And typically, you know, I mentioned a list earlier. A typical list of stakeholders includes managers, employees, suppliers, sometimes the environment, sometimes even competitors, but certainly shareholders. So if shareholders are first among stakeholders, then that's not really stakeholder capitalism.
Right.
So this issue of measurement, I think, can be helpful with respect to understanding what really are the risks that stakeholders take in order to support the business of the corporation. So it's typically used as an excuse to put shareholders first, that they're the ones taking the financial risk. Well, that might be true, but employees take probably financial risks and physical livelihood risks.
Exactly.
The environment takes a risk when there are environmental impacts from corporate activity. So if we get better at measuring those risks in comparison to the financial risks, then maybe we can allocate risk and therefore reward more equitably.
So I'm going to have to let you go, but I used to teach political communication and mass communication. And I remember one day talking to my students, and this is why the question of how you define a stakeholder is so important. And I brought in a TV lens. And I said, if I put my TV lens on this desk, then everything you see is within the scope of that lens. So all you see is some wood and some grain. And then I expand the lens. Oh, you see the desk is in a room. And then I expand the lens. And you see that the room is in a school. And then I expand the lens. And you see the school is in a rural community. And then I expand the lens. That's really the challenge I'm going to challenge you with, Professor Michelson, which is how big a lens are you going to use when you talk to your students? What do your students think about how big a lens you should be using to define stakeholder? And then once you've done that, that has to be what that triple whatever thing you were talking about, that if they're going to talk about the social impacts, the environmental, I want to know who they consider as a stakeholder. And if I don't know who they consider, then I'm not sure you could quadruple whatever the bottom line is. But I need to know who they see as part of the players and the responsibility they have to them.
And in particular, if you only see the stockholders and the managers and the employees and the suppliers,
small lens.
What about the rest of us? What
about
the people that are being harmed by pollution or being harmed by whatever else? And
I will take that challenge, and I will just add as a final comment that not everything that matters can be measured. And so I think maybe meaning is the most important thing that we started with and that we can finish this discussion with.
Absolutely.
Right. And allocation.
How CEOs, experts, and philosophers see the world's biggest risks differently. Professor Christopher Michelson is a professor of ethics and business law. I'm not going to chuckle. University of St. Thomas, thank you so much for putting up with us. I really appreciate it. You're welcome. Ciao.
Thanks.
All right. And how do we end?
We end with a hopeful message of Waiting for the World to Change by John Mayer.
Thanks.
Misunderstood. They say we stand for nothing and there's no way.